always be clear where you get your conservative talk.
The St. Louis Business Journal is now reporting that liberal billionaire George Soros is the largest shareholder of Odyssey,
the parent company of KMOX and 97.1 Talk.
Soros' maneuver raises critical questions about the future of media ownership and influence.
Money and attention is power. And when he has the money and he controls what's on the radio stations, he's going to be able to control the minds, essentially hundreds of millions of Americans.
St. Louis's trusted source and number one.
For conservative talk.
This is News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
Donald Trump lost two debates to me in 2020. Since then, he hadn't shown up for debate. Now he's acting like he wants to debate me again. Well, make my day, pal. I'll even do it twice. So let's pick the dates, Donald. I hear you're free on Wednesdays.
4:06, and welcome into the Hump Day edition of the Tim Jones and Chris Arps Show. My name is Chris Arps. Joey V is on the wheels of steel and remote, in Jefferson City. My partner is in the swamp in Jefferson City. Speaker Tim Jones, you hear there Biden coming out the gate saying that he will debate President Trump as early as next month on CNN. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, Chris, in other news, a huge truck filled with B vitamins was backing up to 1600 Pennsylvania today. Chris, whatever they gave him for the State of the Union, they're going to have to double and triple the dose. Can you imagine Joe Biden on a stage by himself, no teleprompter for 90 minutes, which I guess 90 minutes to 2 hours, facing off against Donald Trump, who apparently has much more of his faculties about him than the current president. So I am ready to pop the popcorn. And Chris, whenever you're ready for it, I have an update from Jefferson City as well on the now 48 plus hour long record breaking filibuster of the Democrats against IP reform.
All right, well, go ahead.
So the word on the street, Chris, as we approach the 50th hour of the filibuster, Democrats not giving any signs that they are interested in slowing down or stopping before the end of session at 6 p.m. on Friday, about 48 hours away from this point in time. The word on the street is that floor leader Cindy O'Loughlin has about had enough. She is ready to move forward. She is trying to assemble the 18 Republicans needed to force a PQ motion and vote. Unfortunately, unless things change, that vote may fall short. There are apparently as many as 8 Republican senators who are refusing to vote to end debate and to vote for SJR 74. There are Republican senators who are going to potentially fail this number one priority of the Republican Party in the state of Missouri for 7 years going.
Who are these senators and why are they doing this?
Well, Chris, I'll give you the current list. Let me give you the bad news first. I've got the list. Let's see, right here. The ones who are not willing to vote for the PQ. And look, Chris, here's the point. The Democrats have, I'm going to give them credit. They have stuck together. They have waged an excellent filibuster. There are 9 of them. They are taking turns holding the floor in 3-hour shifts of teams of 2. Chris, they don't have to stop. They don't have to slow down. They're going strong. They all look fresh as daisies. So honestly, if you're going to rip the Band-Aid off, you might as well do it now and try to salvage a little bit what's left of session, because there are a ton of other bills that are in the pipeline that could get passed. So I understand why the floor leader would be making this decision at this point in time. Unfortunately, these Republican senators have said they won't sign the PQ, which means that will end the session. That will end the aspects of initiative petition reform passing this year. Senate President Caleb Rowden is a no. Senator Jason Bean from the Boot Heel is a no. Mike Bernsketter from Jefferson City is a no. Justin Brown from the Rolla area is a no. Mike Searpoy from Kansas City is a no. Carla Eslinger, she's been appointed by the governor to be the new Commissioner of Education next year. She's a no. Elaine Gannon, Chris, as you said, is home with a broken foot. We've offered to airlift her over to the Capitol. Mm-hmm. She said she's not interested. So she's essentially a no. And one of the most surprising ones, although maybe not, Lincoln Huff, the budget chairman who is running statewide this year for lieutenant governor, is a no. I would argue that if any of those folks vote no, they should not be elected by any Republican in the state to anything else after this year. And Chris, the yeses, Cindy O'Loughlin, Rusty Black, Ben Brown, Jill Carter, Sandy Crawford, Mary Elizabeth Coleman, the bill handler, Travis Fitzwater, Tony Lukedemeyer, Holly Rader, Curtis Trent, Rick Bratton, Bill Eigel, Nick Schroer, Denny Hoskins, Andrew Koenig, and Mike Moon. You got 16 yes votes. You need two more. They said this vote was going to happen about 10 minutes ago. It has not happened yet, so maybe they're trying to get those two more votes needed. If this vote fails, the Senate will essentially be shut down and session in the Senate will be over.
And this is one of those rare times that I advocate for those of you out there to contact your state senator or contact these state senators. Maybe we can get a list put up on the website of these senators that are blocking IP reform in effect, and call them. We've got 2.5 days left until the end of session. This is very important for life. It's very important for, I think, for the credibility of our Constitution, so that it can't be changed willy-nilly by 10% and 15% of the population, which we see so many times. So call these senators, call your own state senator, tell them to support this. Time is running out, but there is still time left to make this happen, right, Tim?
There is, Chris, and that's very important. I'm going to text the list of yeses and nos to you and Joey right now, and maybe Joey and or producer Katie can do something with these names and put them out on social media or something of the sort. And I'll keep you guys posted. I've kind of got one ear cocked on the Senate speaker here in Senator Schroer's office, and I'm watching the board as well. I'll let you all know. The filibuster is currently still going. Like I said, the delay is hopefully a productive delay. Hopefully, Senator Cindy O'Loughlin is trying to get those two more votes she needs. What she's thinking is, look, we've got 2 days left. There are some other good bills in the pipeline. Nothing as critical or as important as initiative petition reform, but some important pieces of legislation. She's thinking, look, I waited as long as I could. I let the Democrats filibuster for approximately 50 hours. They show no signs of stopping or slowing down. So if I'm going to salvage session, I need to call the question on initiative petition reform. Initiative petition reform has passed both chambers several times over the last 6 years. It's never passed both chambers in the same year at the same time and been completed. So it's unfinished business. The Freedom Caucus didn't make this their original priority. They adopted it as a priority this year. It's been a priority for 6 years. I think Speaker Dean Plocker actually first made this a priority 6 or 7 years ago when he filed one of the first significant initiative petition reform bills. The Speaker, to his credit, did everything he could do this year. I'm going to give him huge congrats and kudos for running a pretty efficient House this year. It's been the Senate now. You've got senators who have already voted for this several times the last few years, now suddenly saying, no, we don't want to cut off debate. We'd rather not do that. You know, in the middle of session, I can understand that. We're in the 12th hour. I mean, the second hand is about to hit midnight here. If you're going to get this done, then you kind of need to get it done now. I agree with the floor leader's decision. And then you can salvage a few other important bills for the session. You really can't wait much longer, or you're going to be in the same position for the next 2 days.
Big show today coming up. 424, Zach Smith, senior legal fellow of the Heritage Foundation and co-host of the SCOTUS 101 podcast. Chris's Corner at 445. We'll talk about the latest political news, the latest presidential political news. At 507, we'll have the speaker's stump speech.
Yeah, Chris, I'm going to give, I'll give an update as to the current session. What is possibly going to fly or die in these last 48 hours?
And at 524, a brand new guest we'll have with us, Peter Franzen. He's the Assistant Executive Director of Children's Education Alliance of Missouri, or SEAM. We'll talk to him about Senate Bill 727, his reaction to that education reform bill becoming law. So that'll be at 524. You want to stay tuned and listen to that. We came into the show with the big news. Joe Biden has agreed to debate Donald Trump. I don't know about you, Tim, but my spidey sense kind of goes up. It's like, I will believe this when it happens. I'm also wondering, too, you know, June is very early for a presidential debate. Donald Trump hasn't even secured the nomination yet. I'm wondering, because Joe Biden is in diminished straits? Do they want to have these debates as early as possible in June so that when June comes around, November comes around, the election, the electorate will forget this. Biden has agreed to two debates, probably June and probably one, 2 or 3 weeks later. Then that's it. No summer of no debates. Then you have the election. Could that be their strategy?
I think you're right, Chris, because look what'll happen. So they'll have a debate in June. Maybe they have one in July before the Republican convention or right after. Then that's it. And then Biden gets to have his big glitz and glamoury convention in August in Chicago when they may burn the city down. That may be another host of problems they'll have. But you're right, Chris. Who's going to remember who in November is going to remember a debate that occurred back in June or July, right? You and I will remember bits and pieces of it, but people are busy. They're running businesses, lives. They're trying to figure out how to fill up their gas tanks and their grocery carts and the one of the worst economies we've experienced in the modern age. Hopefully they'll remember and see all that, but you're right. As subject, what happens in a debate, that's going to be a foggy memory. And I think you're spot on. That's exactly why Biden is doing this now. He's hoping to kind of slog through this, not make any massive mistakes, just look like old good old Uncle Joe, and survived to fight another day in November.
You know, people are giving Joe Biden kudos for coming out and debating, challenging President Trump, but there are some stipulations that have been given for this debate. It's not what we think it is on the surface. Cut to Joey.
It should be, yes, in studio with no audience so that the candidates can clearly articulate their vision for the country.
Is an audience a deal breaker? Is an audience a deal breaker for you?
Listen, it's Donald Trump who said he would do this anytime, anywhere, any place. So I don't think that they should have any problems with what we have proposed. He's the one who said he's ready to go. So we should be set to go once we have proposals in from networks.
Now, usually in the studio audience of these debates, they're pretty even-handed, 50-50 with supporters of each candidate. Are they worried that the Trump supporters would be more animated in the debate audience than the Biden supporters? Is that one reason why they don't want a studio audience? Usually, Tim, and you are recovering politicians feed off the energy of people and the audience. You would think someone like Joe Biden, who's been a politician for 60 years, would want an audience in the debate forum with him.
Yeah, Chris, I think that's a good point. I also think they want to try to limit distractions. Joe Biden is 82 and a half years old. You can tell in public events where there's a lot going on, he gets lost, right? He starts wandering around stages, shaking hands with people who aren't there, wondering where he's supposed to go next, looking very confused. And I think that's because in those settings, the noise, the pomp and circumstance, it distracts him. And so I think that's what they're also concerned about is if you've got a studio audience, whether it's in favor of you or not, there's going to be cheering, there's going to be clapping, hooting and hollering. I think they're afraid that that will distract Joe. He'll get thrown off his games. He won't be able to follow his talking points. So I think that's another reason as well. They're going to try to make this as sanitized and sterile and as controlled an environment as possible so they can juice up Joe with whatever they put in his system these days to get him focused for 90 minutes and hope that he doesn't run out of gas.
President Trump was on the Hugh Hewitt show yesterday, and here was his response to Joe Biden agreeing to debate.
You know, he's issuing it. I wonder whether or not he shows up because, you know, he also challenged me to golf. So I'm a very good golfer. He can't hit a ball 50 yards. He said, I'll give him 3 a side. But he knows he'll never play. This is sort of like that, I think. But I hope not because I really think he has to debate. He might as well get it over with. Probably should do it early so that he can, you know, because he's not going to get any better.
I hope if there are debates, I hope that President Trump does not repeat his performance of his first debate where he wouldn't let Joe Biden put his foot in his mouth and let the country see what a aging person Joe Biden was. He kind of walked over his message a lot. Joe Biden is going to be the focal point of these debates. People are going to be wondering, is he still up to the job? Is he going to be making any mistakes? The bar is going to be quite low for him. Of course, but as Joe Biden's handlers always say, let Joe Biden be Joe Biden. I agree with that. Let Joe Biden be Joe Biden. Let the public see that their president is not capable of doing the job.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, Chris. What Donald Trump should do is hammer, like, just wait for the question and then hammer Biden on his record. I mean, you could spend 2 hours just going through the failed record of Joe Biden. Bidenomics, Bidenflation, what he's done on the world stage, what he's done to the border, what he's done to kids, the education system, the weird trans cult, women's sports, right? You could just hammer him on that. And then when the questions go to Biden, let Biden be Biden. I agree with you, Chris. Let Biden fail on his lonesome. We don't need Donald Trump stepping in and essentially bailing him out, right? Like stepping on every answer. Let Joe ramble and bumble and stumble or get angry or whatever his weird, you know, synchronicities, idiosyncrasies are these days. I agree. Let Biden be Biden and Trump should just hammer the record.
The big news today, of course, is the announcement of these debates. But Tim, there is still a trial going on in New York. The hush money trial with the Stormy Daniels and Donald Trump. We've got the perfect guest to talk about that coming up next. He is, of course, Zach Smith. He's a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. We'll ask Zach about this trial and the Supreme Court and other legal matters when we come back to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9/94.1 News Talk STL, number one for live and local conservative talk.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
How do we have a large body of people that are in our city and country that are excellent swimmers, and at the same time, we need lifeguards? And the only obstacle is that we won't give them the right to work to become a lifeguard.
4:26 on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. You know, Tim, I wonder, should these illegal aliens who were excellent swimmers, maybe they should get expedited B-1 visas. Let's ask our next guest about that and other legal matters in the news.
Zach Smith, legal fellow with the Heritage Foundation.
You know, I ask you a lot of predictions. Can you predict what the Supreme Court probably will do with this action? Zach, you heard the mayor of New York there, Eric Adams. He says that illegal aliens are excellent swimmers and that we should be employing them as lifeguards at New York City municipal pools. Do you agree with that? Should they be given expedited visas because they're excellent swimmers and we have a lifeguard shortage apparently in New York City?
Well, Chris, I think the answer to that is they should be given expedited consideration back to their home countries. And so if the mayor's in favor of expediting the deportation process, I fully support that. Otherwise, I am not with him at all.
Think about the kids, Zach. They need the kids and they need lifeguards at the kids. Why do you hate kids, Zach?
Yeah, but Chris, I thought he was going to have to shut off summer programs, close the pools, all of this other nonsense, because he's applying too much of his budget to house and feed these illegal aliens who are in the country illegally.
Zach, the crime problem in most of, if not all of urban America isn't going away, is it? You've actually written the book on it with your colleague, Cully Stimson. You do a lot of writing and prognosticating on this. Zach, this is now having real world effects, isn't it? Like businesses shutting down, businesses that have never shut down anywhere ever before. I think you made a pilgrimage out to one of the crazy towns, maybe on the left coast. In-N-Out Burger, permanently closing locations, other businesses. Zach, we've seen it here in St. Louis. Part of it was the pandemic, but a lot of it is the defund the police, soft on crime policies of, you know, our former Soros-funded prosecutor, Kim Gardner. Our left-leaning mayor hasn't made anything better since Gardner's departure. Zach, these talking points, these activist talking points, I guess my question is, they have real world consequences, don't they?
Yeah, 100%, Tim. And actually, the In-N-Out story is actually more outrageous than that. A lot of people may not realize this is police week this week. And so, Cully and I have both been talking a lot about law and order, defunding the police, why that's a bad idea. And we actually are releasing this week a 5-part series called Societal Rot. It doesn't have to be this way. And so you mentioned yesterday I released a short video from when we went out to California in Oakland, Alameda County there. An In-N-Out Burger, in its 75-year history, has never, never closed a single store permanently until March 24th of this year, when it closed its only location in Oakland, California. And the reason it closed the store for the first time ever was because of the crime and the public safety issues. Essentially, In-N-Out said that it was no longer safe for its staff and its customers to work at that location. And so because of that, they had to close the store. And of course, this was due to the defund, the police policies, the soft on crime policies of the Oakland local elected Oakland officials there. And then of the rogue prosecutor, Pamela Price, who's currently in the process of undergoing a recall effort there in Alameda County. But you're absolutely right, Tim. These policies, these supposedly feel-good talking points that so many on the left support, have real-world consequences and harm the communities wherever they're implemented.
Well, we're speaking with Zach Smith, senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation and co-host of the SCOTUS 101 podcast. Zach, as you know, President Trump has lost his latest attempt to undo his gag order in the Manhattan hush money criminal case. I'm wondering, is Donald Trump getting around the gag order with surrogates when he has those speaking out before the cameras and the microphones, saying the things that Donald Trump wants to say, but he can't because he has a gag order? And also, Donald Trump has been reading quotes from columns saying the things that he probably would want to say. Could he be penalized for going against the gag order by doing these things?
Chris, I feel like you're throwing me a law school hypothetical with this question here. Look, I've seen this same point raised in the media. You know, the gag order itself is already on constitutionally questionable grounds. We've talked about it before. Prior restraints prohibiting people from speaking under pain of either civil or criminal penalties are generally broadly disfavored in our legal system. And yeah, that's exactly what's being done to Donald Trump. And it's even more egregious when you consider he's running the president of the United States, when you consider that others like Michael Cohen are out in the public, he's saying bad things about Donald Trump that he's not really able to respond to, when you consider that the salacious and largely unnecessary testimony of Stormy Daniels has been breathlessly reported in the mainstream media, even though it wasn't really relevant to the criminal charges. You know, even when you consider all of that, you know, the idea that the judge would try to somehow expand this gag order even further to prohibit other individuals from speaking or from repeating, you know, information that's already out in the public domain, I think would place the gag order on even more of a constitutionally questionable and shaky footing. And I think, frankly, you know, if Donald Trump ends up being convicted, and I'm not sure that's a guarantee at this point, even with a Manhattan jury, even though it's a very unfavorable jury for Donald Trump, you know, I think the judge has created several legal issues that will tee up nicely and could potentially lead to a reversal if this case is ever appealed.
Zach, there's been several legal commentators, several of them former judges, esteemed law professors, who have said, you know, we know it's a Manhattan jury. We know it's a probably very liberal, left-leaning judge. But the prosecution, after 18 days, including the testimony of their star witness, adjudicated liar Michael Cohen, they as a matter of fact and law, they haven't proven the elements of the case. There's still this ambiguous connection between two New York misdemeanors and a third yet to be named campaign finance misdemeanor, which may be under New York law, maybe under the federal elections code, which was previously dismissed by the FEC. I mean, I know they probably won't do it, Zach, but if there was ever a case for a directed verdict after the prosecutor's case, this is arguably it, isn't it?
Well, I certainly think there's a compelling case to be made for that outcome. I also think it's not out of the realm of possibility that the jury could either acquit Donald Trump or more likely could potentially be a hung jury, meaning they can't reach a decision. And the prosecutors could theoretically retry Donald Trump at that point. But I think they would need to sit down and seriously evaluate whether that would make, you know, any any more sense than this current prosecution does. But look, I think the prosecution, just from the blocking and tackling needed to prove their case, has been an absolute abomination. I don't think it should come as a surprise to anybody that whenever you hinge your case on someone who has a history of lying, someone who has been accused of being a serial perjurer like Michael Cohen, that you're likely to face issues. And Michael Cohen's credibility really is at the center of this case, because the testimony is essential to proving the charges against Donald Trump. And so there are very real issues, like you mentioned, Tim. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not Donald Trump will testify. I suspect, you know, most defense attorneys typically advise their clients not to take the stand. You know, you have the right not to testify at trial. Most defendants avail themselves of that right. And so it'll be very interesting to see kind of what the end game is as the prosecution starts to wrap up its case in chief.
We're speaking with Zach Smith, senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation and co-host of the SCOTUS 101 podcast. Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, at a recent judicial conference in Austin, Zach said that the Supreme Court needs to take on more cases, 75 more than 60, and he defended the courts taking on more cases on an emergency basis without oral arguments. Your thoughts on this, sir?
I largely agree with those particular comments. Now, Justice Kavanaugh made some other comments as well at that conference that I may not be as much in agreement on, and we can get into some of that. But at least on this point, I think he's absolutely right. The Supreme Court needs to take more cases. If you look at the Supreme Court's caseload over the past decade to two decades, you'll see it's dropped precipitously, almost in half of where it was even 10, 15 years ago. And there are many, many cases outstanding with very important legal issues that need to be resolved. And I think, and I suspect, part of why we are now getting very lengthy opinions, very complex opinions with numerous separate writings by judges, numerous separate dissents, is because the justices, frankly, have a lot of time on their hands. They have the ability to write these very lengthy decisions. Whereas instead of doing that, I think it would be better to resolve the issues, you know, write a decision that explains the rationale and then move on, decide the next case. And yet that is not happening right now. So I think that criticism and observation by Justice Kavanaugh is absolutely correct.
Speaking to Zach Smith of the Heritage Foundation, Zach, the Supreme Court term is completely wrapped up as far as oral arguments, right? We're just waiting for the decision. Zach, typically, when does the first set of decisions start to drop? When can we expect to start talking about those and receiving those decisions? And, you know, what I'm sure they'll save the biggest and the best for last. What do you think we might see in the beginning when these start dropping over the next 30 days or so is probably what's going to happen next 4 to 5 weeks?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Tim. You know, it's a little bit like waiting next to a labor and delivery room in some sense. You're just waiting, you know, for the baby to drop, if you will. But you're right. You know, in fact, the Supreme Court has an opinion release day scheduled on its calendar tomorrow morning. So we'll see what opinions they release. So far, they've just been releasing one or two at a time. But they still have many, many opinions outstanding, and they have to release all the opinions traditionally by the end of June. And so it will likely be a very busy next 4 to 5 weeks for court watchers and everyone really who's interested in the law. And, you know, some of the biggest opinions outstanding are the ones involving the deference courts have to give to unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats. We've talked about that before. The Chevron deference, whether that doctrine will survive intact or whether it will be overturned. There are a couple of big cases outstanding about the power and scope and the structure of administrative agencies. There's one involving the CFPB, whether its structure is constitutional. There's an important case involving the SEC and its ability to conduct in-house trials, whether certain actions have to go through the court system like we would expect them to, or whether the SEC can essentially enforce its own penalties in-house. So that'll be a very important case to watch as well. And then there are several very important cases involving the First Amendment and social media companies. There are two cases involving the power of the states to regulate those companies, the NetChoice cases, one out of Florida, one out of Texas, whether states can require social media companies to platform individuals or whether they can be deplatformed because of their viewpoints. And then, of course, there's the Murphy versus Missouri case. Whether the Biden administration essentially colluded with big tech to suppress speech that was disfavored, and whether, you know, if that happens, what are the remedies for that that offending conduct? So a lot is set to come out in the next several weeks, and I think we'll have plenty to talk about.
Zach, last week TikTok sued to challenge the law forcing its sale or ban, and just today five plaintiffs filed their own suit to stop the sale or ban of TikTok. Your thoughts on how successful these suits will be?
Yeah, good luck with that is what I can say. But in all seriousness, look, they may have some success in the lower federal courts. But I suspect once it gets up to the courts of appeals, and certainly if it makes its way to the Supreme Court, I don't expect them to have a very favorable outcome. Look, you know, I think everyone recognizes that Congress, while they can't favor certain viewpoints or disfavor certain types of speech over other, they can certainly act to protect the national interests of the United States. And I do think it was very telling, Chris, that after this bill was passed that would essentially force TikTok's parent company to sell its algorithm and its sources, basically, TikTok said, no, we're not going to do that. We'd rather just lose all of our revenue, all of our capital, because essentially we don't want that, you know, getting out in the public domain. And that was very telling, I thought, because it was essentially proving the point of why it was so important for Congress to take this action and force the sale of TikTok. So look, I suspect you'll see legal arguments. You've often heard people talk about this, bringing it as a First Amendment issue, but it's really not. Congress is clearly within its power to act to protect the national interest of the United States, and that's exactly what they did with this piece of legislation.
Excellent. Yeah.
Zach, to go full circle, I noticed on your Twitter feed at TZ Smith that in follow up to your book, Rogue Prosecutors, that I mentioned earlier, you've got a special series this week up on the Daily Signal, dailysignal.com, about rogue prosecutors and the consequences of their lax on crime agenda. You know, Zach, it seems like the media can only follow one bouncing ball at a time. This was a big story maybe a year ago or so, but the closer we get to the election, it seems like they don't want to talk about crime and law and order in the United States of America. Everything must be great again, right, Zach?
Apparently, if you listen to Karine Jean-Pierre, she'll tell you crime is falling. She'll tell you that Joe Biden has actually been incredibly successful at bringing down violent crime rates. Although I suspect if you go talk to the good people in St. Louis or Baltimore, Chicago, or L.A. or New York, they'll tell you a very different story. In fact, I just saw on the news Steve Buscemi was walking down the streets of New York City, was punched in the face by a random individual. So this type of crime is not going away. And, you know, what happens when Karine Jean-Pierre and others on the left cite those statistics, it's actually very misleading. They cite national crime statistics, which aren't really relevant to the discussion because crime is a localized phenomenon. They also fail to mention that the FBI has changed the way they collect and report crime statistics. And as a result, many of the country's biggest cities are either delayed or are not reporting some or all of their crime statistics. And so you can imagine that'll show crime being lower than it actually is. But I think it's very clear that unfortunately in our country today, we have a violent crime problem that is not only affecting the safety and ability of us as individuals to live in our communities, but it's also causing great economic harm as well, forcing businesses, particularly small businesses, to either close up shop or reduce hours or take other precautionary measures that they otherwise wouldn't have to do.
And finally, Zach, this week's SCOTUS 101 podcast episode?
We'll have to be determined, Chris. We'll have to wait and see what decisions the court releases tomorrow. If it's a blockbuster day with a lot of decisions, we'll certainly have an episode. But stay tuned. We have a couple of good interviews lined up with some sitting judges, some other academics as well. And so I think there'll be a good couple of episodes as we quickly race toward the end of the Supreme Court's term.
Excellent. That is Zach Smith, Senior Legal Fellow of the Heritage Foundation and co-host of the SCOTUS 101 podcast on Twitter. He is TZ Smith, and you can also read his excellent work at heritage.org. Zach, thank you so much. Have a great weekend, and we'll speak with you again next Wednesday.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me on. Take care.
Excellent. 4:44, and we'll have coming up on Chris's Corner, we'll talk about some of the big stories of the day, some political stories regarding Joe Biden and the presidential campaign. 5:07, speaker stump speech. And at 5:24, Peter Franzen, assistant executive director of Children's Education Alliance of Missouri, will talk to him about Senate Bill 727, the historic education reform bill that has now become law. You are listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9/94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
A white woman is missing, and she's got the, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes, that kind of thing. The media attention is out of this world. But if a black woman goes missing, it's deaf ears.
House Bill 3913 would establish an executive office for missing and murdered black females that would, for one thing, keep track of the numbers. It would also create what sponsors are calling the Ebony Alert, modeled after the Amber Alert.
4:50 on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show, and a very interesting bill there, the Ebony Alert. Mm-hmm, now, mm-hmm. There has been, I think, necessary spotlight on there has been many missing black children, black women, and it doesn't seem to get the attention that other missing women do. But do we need a bill to call the Ebony Alert to bring attention to it? It seems like you are focusing on the fact that people's lives appear to be unequal. And with this law, you seem to be putting more emphasis on black women's lives than other missing women's lives. Am I wrong here, Tim?
Chris, you would have done well on the Senate floor on the debate on this. I happened to accidentally have wandered into the chamber that day. There were some folks up here. We were showing around, and I said, hey, you want to go see what they're talking about on the Senate floor? And it was kind of a random afternoon about 2 weeks ago. And we sat down, and that very bill was being debated. And Chris, that question came up, and the folks I was with, they had the same response. They were like, well, aren't we worried about everybody who goes missing? I mean, shouldn't this be a bill for all missing people, no matter who they are, no matter where they are? And Senator Mike Moon asked a really good question, Chris, and offered an amendment during the debate on this bill. He said, you know what? While we're debating missing women, how about we define what a woman is? And he actually put it forth an amendment to define woman. The Democrats voted it down.
And you can always tell when it is campaign season because you see bills like this that are Afrocentric in their nature. And you also see the politicians making the rounds, going to the black churches, doing the black events. We'll talk more about that next on Chris's Corner.
Chris. And if you don't know, now you know.
And now, Chris's Corner.
It is no secret that Joe Biden is doing historically bad with the African-American community. Some polls show him at 67%. Poll the other day showed that Donald Trump gaining 23% of the African-American vote as a whole. Democrats know that part of their election strategy means holding on to their very strong black constituency. They know they cannot lose any part of that group, or there is no way that they can win. And so we're seeing the so-called black outreach that the Democrats typically do earlier, happening earlier than we normally do. Usually, but September, October, you see the black church visit, you see the other pandering things. But now we are seeing it here in May. We just played that clip there of Massachusetts Democrats sponsoring the Ebony Alert. And we see this week, President Joe Biden. On Thursday, he is set to meet with plaintiffs from the landmark Brown versus Board of Education case and their families. On Friday, he'll give remarks at the NAACP event featuring the Brown plaintiffs and members of the Little Rock Nine. On Saturday, President Biden heads to Atlanta for a campaign event. And on Sunday, he will give the commencement address at Morehouse College, the legendary all-male HBCU, before traveling to Detroit for the annual NAACP Freedom Fund Dinner. This is most definitely Black Week, an entire week that is dedicated to Black interests and shoring up President Biden's sagging African American support. You know, yesterday was Election Day, and we are still having elections. A couple of them were very notable. One was the Senate, Democratic Senate primary in Maryland. David Trone, who is a multi-millionaire, who owns the second largest liquor store chain, if I have that correct, spent $60 million of his own money in this race, and he lost to the Prince George's County executive, Angela Also Brooks, who's an African-American female. She is the county executive there in Prince George's County. She lost to him she beat him by more than 10 points. So Maryland is looking at potentially having its first African-American female senator. But Larry, can't think of his name right now. Larry, the former governor of Maryland, he is in the race as well, running on the Republican side. He won his election, and he is doing very well in the polls when he was matched up with Trone and also Brooks. So a state that the Democrats probably took for granted and knew that they had a safe Democratic seat is now up in the air, even though it does probably lean a little bit Democrat. We know all the furor that happened last week when President Biden stopped shipments of heavy weapons to Israel in their fight against Hamas. Joe Biden was criticized heavily by many Democrats. 15 Democrats sent a letter to the White House demanding that aid continue to be sent. There is a bill that is working through the House now. It's called the Israel Security Assistance Support Act, which has come to the House floor today. This legislation calls for all the aid that was passed in the Israel Assistance Bill to be sent to Israel as quickly as possible. The Democrats, or Joe Biden, the administration have been calling Democrats, trying to show up support, trying to get them not to vote for this, but there could be 20 to 25 or more Democrats that have voted for this. To counter this, the White House has announced a weapons package for Israel that is worth more than $1 billion. This is to give cover for those that will not vote for the previous bill, the Israel Security Assistance Support Act, but they can vote for this $1 billion in aid. That is the carrot that the White House is giving to try to give cover for Israel. Boy, this is a real mess. President Biden has said at the beginning of this situation that he stands ironclad with Israel. The White House will still try to tell you that they're still standing strong with Israel, but they won't give them the weapons that they need to finish Hamas off. And that, Tim Jones, is Chris's Corner.
Yeah, Chris, what a disaster, huh? And look, let's keep this in context. 35,000 foot, Israel is the only liberal democracy in the Middle East. Joe Biden is siding with the authoritarian theocratic jihadists, the terrorists.
507 is Speaker Stump's speech, and at 524, Peter Franzen, Assistant Executive Director of SEEM, talked to him about the education bill. You're listening to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show on 101.9/94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.